You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Meera Sivasuthi. There are 6,500 road deaths a year in Malaysia. And to tackle this problem, a change of mindset is needed, with the drivers obeying the rules. A quick comparison in statistics in Malaysia, there is one death per 2,200 registered vehicles. In contrast, the UK had one death per 13,500 registered vehicles. And joining us today to talk about cultural aspects of road safety are Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd, the Assistant Professor of Psychology, and Dr. David Crundall, an Associate Professor and expert on the psychology of driving. Welcome, both of you, to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. David, you've been here, what? When did you... You just arrived, and this is your first visit to Malaysia.
Yes, I've been here just a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. What hit you about our driving?
Well, it's quite an experience, I must admit. I got in at the airport, picked up the hire car, and driving down, the road seemed quite nice. It wasn't quite rush hour then.
You drove as soon as you landed?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. That's very brave.
Foolhardy, some might say, even. just that drive was not enough to prepare me for KL rush hour,
sure. As
I found out yesterday.
And you hit the rush hour. What was that like?
Well, it was somewhat organized chaos, it seemed. Cars everywhere.
What was the most difficult thing that you had to do?
I think one of the really important things that I've noticed here is situational awareness for your space and everyone who's around you. In the UK, one of the things that that we know is bad in some drivers is checking mirrors. Over here, checking mirrors is not just a minor lapse. It's potentially knocking somebody off a motorcycle who could be coming up on either side.
Yeah.
So that it became very apparent to me very early on that having a complete understanding of where everyone is around you is vitally important.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you tackle the changing of lanes during chock-a-block traffic?
With great care.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did people even let you in?
Well, it's very interesting because there certainly seems to be a certain attitude where one has to stick the front of the car out in order to create a gap, mm-hmm. in order to get in, and that's not something that we'd have in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, however, if I...
And the other person tries his level best not to let you in.
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm. Although, the interesting thing about what we have here, which comes back to the cultural differences between the two countries, is that if you were to do that in the UK, and sometimes you might have to, you risk really upsetting the driver that you're cutting in front of. Here, however, because it is so commonplace, everyone seems quite happy for you to pull in and they'll give you a few inches to get through, and whereas an English driver or UK driver might be quite irate at that, everyone here seems to take it in their pace.
Dr. Elizabeth, you've been here how long? You've been here much longer than David has.
I've been here for nearly 2 years now.
Mm-hmm. And when did you start driving?
I was not quite as brave as David. It took me a few months to pluck up the courage to get a car.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it definitely took a few more months before I was really confident on the roads. And even now, I'm probably not fully assimilated to the Malaysian way, but I'm getting there. Yeah. I've learned a lot in this past few months.
I'm curious, you know, when you go home, how do you go back to driving the way they do in the UK after, you know, the sort of driving that you do here?
Well, it does require some adaptation, and it was something I was very worried about because the consequences of driving with a, let's say, Malaysian style in the UK are quite possibly going to be an arrest or some kind of penalties on my license. So I was concerned that I wouldn't remember, to essentially behave according to all of the rules. But I think that once you're in that environment where everyone else is doing what they're supposed to be doing, then actually quite quickly you do pick it up and remember how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Is it pretty much in your subconscious, really? You just got to bring it back to the front when you go home.
I guess so. I mean, I spent a lot of time driving in the UK beforehand, so I was fully trained and very, very used to the habit of driving quite well. So probably for me, it is all there. Whether it's there in the subconscious of people who perhaps haven't really spent any time driving according to the rules, which they do know. It's hard to say.
Okay. The both of you are about to commence a research project that will investigate cross-cultural aspects of driving performance, and in particular, driving hazard perception. What made you even want to do this?
Well, we've already talked now about the striking differences between the behaviour of people on the roads in the two countries. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are many factors that are likely to contribute to these differences. But one aspect of driver behaviour, which we've both studied before, and one that's gained quite a lot of interest in the UK, is this aspect which we call hazard perception. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like we really had a unique opportunity to be able to compare cohorts of drivers in the two locations on this particular scale.
Mm-hmm. David, you've done research on hazard perception in the UK. What is it all about?
Well, hazard perception is basically defined as the ability to spot and respond to something, an event that is dangerous that is unfolding in the road ahead. And essentially, the argument is that if you are good at spotting a particular hazard, such as a car exiting from a side road, then that means that when you're actually on the road, you'll be able to spot this as well. Now, the way that hazard perception testing is done is we don't put people into real cars. It's very much a simplified test. We put people in front of a video screen or a computer monitor, and they watch clips of driving. So they're sat in front of this video clip of driving, and they press a button whenever they think something hazardous is taking place. Those people who press the button sooner than others are meant to be safer on the roads. And certainly the UK thought that the evidence was good enough that they introduced the hazard perception test into the driver licensing procedure in 2002. Evidence that came out in 2008, published by the government, suggests that it's had a significant effect in reducing certain types of accidents.
Right. So if you don't score very well on it, so does that mean you don't get your license?
Yes.
Wow. And, you know, would that be one of the reasons why the accident rate in the UK has come down tremendously?
Well, the government has, as we said, just published some research that suggests that there is a relationship between the introduction of this test and the decrease in accidents in the first year after passing the test. So it's one measure that seems to have some potential. Whether or not this would transfer to the Malaysian context, we don't know. That's why we're doing the research, is to see whether there is going to be any transfer to this other culture. But we can look at the UK as a model and say that this, you know, there's good reason to think that perhaps it could be something that's useful here too.
Right. What's the difference between, I mean, we have something called defensive driving here. What's the difference between hazard perception and defensive driving?
Well, defensive driving is a form of hazard management. You are trying to mitigate the number of hazards that you come into contact with, and it's a very, very sensible strategy to undertake. Hazard perception is more about trying to spot hazards that other people are creating. So through the act of your own driving, you will not be able to rule out all potential hazards. You will still come across other hazards which are caused by other individuals that defensive driving will not be able to fully remove. So I think the two need to be taken together. You need to drive safely, but you also need to be aware of other drivers, other road users, and predict where they're going to be in order to identify hazards.
We are talking about cross-cultural aspects of road safety. We're comparing the UK and Malaysia with Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd and Dr. David Crundall. If you have a question for them, do text us on 016-201-9000, or you can tweet us on BFM Radio. Now, according to the Malay Mail in April last year, Malaysian drivers are blasé about being caught for traffic offences, and many cut corners if they think that they can get away with it. How would you suggest we tackle this sort of mindset? I mean, let's just say we incorporate hazard perception into our, you know, curriculum for passing to get your driver's license. What's this? How do you tackle this sort of attitude, you know?
Well, what we're talking about is the requirement for a major change in the overall culture. And we feel that in general terms that this can only really be achieved through multiple measures in combination. So firstly, enforcement of the laws that are in place. secondly, through changes to the infrastructure, so the way that the roads are, improvements to them. And then thirdly, and perhaps most importantly, through education. So we need to be teaching people from a much younger age what is the right way to behave. And it's really only through a combination of these measures that these changes can occur. And they'll probably occur slowly.
Okay, coming up, we'll find out how, or the psychology of why Malaysians are habitual traffic offenders on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and I'm Mira Sivasuthi. We have Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd, an Assistant Professor of Psychology, and Dr. David Crundall, an Associate Professor and Expert on the Psychology of Driving. We are talking about cultural aspects of road safety. Now, Elizabeth, you mentioned a couple of things just now. Enforcement, infrastructure, and education are vital. Now, let's just tackle the education bit about educating our young, to do the right things. But how do we ensure that new drivers don't get sucked into the whole system that's already existing? I mean, most of us were taught to do the right things in school.
In psychology, we talk about social learning theory, mm-hmm. which is this idea that we actually tend to base a lot of behavior on what we observe in other people. And children and young people in general tend to be highly influenced by the behavior of their parents. So parents themselves have some responsibility to try and, set an example in the way that they're driving, because quite likely if their children see them cutting a lot of corners or behaving in quite a reckless way, then when they come to the age of driving, they will also start to behave the same way. So I think actually perhaps appealing to parents and saying to them, this is going to be a basis for how your children behave, and teaching them the right way to drive and setting an example of them might actually impact on whether your child lives or dies in the future. Mm-hmm. This could be quite a strong way to target this particular thing.
Right. And then talk about, enforcement. We often blame the lack of enforcement for bad behavior. But is it really all about enforcement?
Well, I don't think it's all about enforcement. I think enforcement plays a very important role. Mm-hmm. Certainly laws are important. You have to have laws, and laws without enforcement are not very useful. However, if you have enforcement of laws without the other two strands, without a suitable infrastructure to give people the information so that they can perform the correct behaviours, and without suitable education, training, information to tell people why they should be doing certain behaviours and how to do them, then it won't work on its own.
Mm-hmm. Now, it was interesting. When I read, I had no idea. Habitual traffic offenders are the main cause of accidents in this country. The Road Transport Department estimates that at any one time, there may be over 1.4 million habitual traffic offenders on the road. And we have currently about 12 million people with driving licenses. This is a lot. How would you describe the psychology of habitual traffic offenders? That's the majority of us.
Yeah, I think if I was describing it in the UK, the definition of a habitual traffic offender would be very different, because in the UK, people who are habitual offenders are doing so blatantly, and they know exactly what rules they're breaking, and they know that they are behaving in an extremely risky manner. However, over here, because we've got such a widespread social norm of infringements of certain laws and certain types of behaviours, then it's quite possible that many of those people who we would class as habitual offenders actually don't consider themselves to be habitual offenders, but consider themselves to be behaving as the rest of the population does.
Okay.
So that means that we have to really tackle that by explaining where the line is drawn between who is a habitual offender, who is a dangerous person on the road, and the rest, hopefully the majority of people, who would like to drive safely. Once that line is drawn, we can start to then make it socially unacceptable to be the wrong side of that line.
Okay, we have a question here from Vigneswaran, who says, Malaysians are always rushing and generally lead a stressful life. Now, their stress is manifested in the way they drive. Why don't we educate people about this and have stress tests, but then people in the UK are stressed as well, isn't it? What would you
have? Yes. Yes, I'm driving in London, for instance, you do have a lot of people getting around from A to B who are under immense time pressure. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're very aware of the social responsibilities that they have and the levels of enforcement that are around. Of course, the UK has perhaps got, in the world, the most cameras per square meter of land. So if you're not going to be spotted by a policeman, the odds are a traffic camera or a speed camera will pick you up. A lot of people in the UK don't like that. They think it's a big brother society, but at the same time, it does make sure that that enforcement is always there in the mind. I think those combinations of things help mitigate the stress-related desire to speed.
Right. What's the fine for speeding, for an example, in the UK?
Well, interestingly, you should ask that, because the to coincide with the United Nations Decade of Road Decade of Action on Road Safety, which was launched a couple of weeks ago, the UK government produced a framework document for changes to UK road laws. And one of those proposed laws is to increase the fine to £100 for all bad driving behaviour. So speeding, normally we'd pay £60 or go on a speed awareness course. But that looks like it might be going up to £100, plus new offences might be coming in. So in the UK, we're not really allowed to undertake anyone. Occasionally it happens, but mostly people behave quite well. However, now it's considered that there might be a law coming into it, which actually means that if police catch you undertaking, you will also get a £100 fine.
Right, okay. £100, we get fined £300 here. And then we are entitled to discounts at times. So, what's your take on discounts? Should there be discounts or not?
Well, I think the discounts are a very useful thing in terms of...
when you have like 10, you know, fines to pay up?
They're useful in terms of getting the money back into to the government coffers, because if people think that they can pay within a couple of weeks and get a discount, and if that helps the money come in, then that's useful. But if you're discounting to an extent where you lose the incentive to behave, then you've perhaps lost something.
Oh, well, I know most people would just pay it and continue accumulating those fines after, isn't it? Now, the presence of traffic police officer, does that make people abide by the rules? Or do you think that really makes a difference?
Yes, it does. I mean, having a police officer there is likely to make people abide by the rules. But and in the UK, we've been talking about, they actually have started using even cardboard cutouts of policemen as deterrents, because even if people just think there's a policeman there, then they will much more likely abide by the rules. The problem is, of course, that there are limitations to the amount of resources. There are limitations to the number of policemen available for this sort of thing. So it's not really a long-term solution. It does show that if there is a policeman there and if the policeman enforces the law, then this will result in good behaviour, but it's not a long-term solution to driving problems.
Okay, we have another question here from a listener. What is your hypothesis that Malaysian drivers, since they are more used to driving in organised chaos, his argument is that we are innately more perceptive to hazards?
Well, this is one possibility, actually. In some ways, I have been very impressed with the overall level of skill with which Malaysian people drive, because they do use much narrower margins for error and
get away with it.
Yeah, and I know that the accident level is high, but people do generally successfully drive like this. Mm-hmm. So it is quite possible that people here actually have, ironically, have a higher level of expertise. They're much more used to dealing with hazards, so they may overall perform better. We also may see cultural differences in performance with particular kinds of hazards because of the kinds of hazards that are naturally occurring in the two environments may be quite different. And these are all things that we want to try and explore with our research.
Okay, what about women? Are women safer drivers or are they not? There's always this perception that women aren't very good on the road.
Well, in the UK, our biggest target group for accidents are young novice drivers who have just passed their test. Interestingly, the drivers that are learning to drive don't tend to have many accidents when they've got a responsible adult sat next to them. But once they've passed their test, the first 6 months to a year are particularly dangerous times, and they're very much overrepresented in the crash statistics. However, when you split that down by gender, you see the bump of accident statistics for both genders, but it is much reduced for female drivers. Now, that's not necessarily to say that they have better skill, and there is debate about that, but certainly there is an argument there that perhaps women are more cautious drivers in certain situations.
Sure. And, you know, trying to change the culture of our drivers in that process is going to be extremely difficult to minimize stiff resistance. I mean, it is going to come with, you know, tremendous resistance. How do you go about this?
Well, it's definitely going to be a need to tackle this early on. So education needs to happen at the various very earliest levels. You almost need to inoculate the youth of tomorrow or the young drivers of tomorrow against the mindsets of the older drivers. However, if you leave the older drivers to their own devices, you're going to create a two-tier safety system. So what you also need to do is to tackle those particular individuals as well. Now, the interesting thing is that many different countries around the world have used different approaches to this, and I think that all of their approaches are very culturally specific. So, for instance, advertising campaigns in the UK for motorcycle safety and car safety are focused on rational approaches and providing information, whereas in, I think, Northern Ireland, they are definitely more focused on emotive adverts, which have contained graphic displays of accident collisions. Mm-hmm. And I think there is space for very different approaches, certainly with very different cultures as well. But also, every individual will differ in terms of what button needs to be pressed in order to make them be aware of the dangers that they're facing and change their behaviour.
That's right. I remember my parents, right, when in those days we didn't have safety belts in the car, and then they introduced it, and then, you know what, this is exactly what they would do. They would pull the safety belt over and not buckle it. And I always used to wonder why, you know. It's a form of resistance. You know, I mean, did they not understand the whole idea behind it? It had to do with safety and not something that government says you have to do or abide by, you know what I mean? So I suppose it's the whole education process and how you go about educating people, isn't it? We have another question here from Mr. G, who says, what about our roads infrastructure, as you just mentioned just now? Motorbike lanes, bad situation, not maintained, all of this not maintained well, which forces road users who take shortcuts and possibly even break the laws while doing so. So you know we didn't really touch on infrastructure. Do you want to go through that?
I suppose one thing that I noticed was on some of the roads, for instance, just the markings are very indistinct. Mm-hmm. You have traffic straddling lanes, primarily because the markings aren't there. I say primarily, I've seen them straddling lanes when the markings have been very clear as well. The markings have to be there as one of the three tenets that are going to help bring road safety about here. But in advance to that, making sure that signage is correct, making sure that when roads meet, that there is an organised way for traffic to merge, and just simple things like filling in potholes, which is a problem that we really do have in the UK as well.
You have potholes there?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, we have it because of the weather. So we have very cold winters, and then as soon as the spring comes, the roads break up and holes appear.
That's because of expansion and contraction.
Yes.
When do you hope to complete this study? Have you started it already?
We're just actually filming the hazard clips in Malaysia at the moment. Mm-hmm.
Are you filming this?
We don't do it in a very high-tech way. We have a video camera inside a car, and we drive around using a variety of different road environments, road contexts. A lot of the hazards that we're using are naturally occurring hazards. Mm-hmm. As you said, they're fairly frequent on the roads here, so we're getting a very wide library of driving hazards to use for this. Sometimes we'll also stage particular hazard setups if we need a particular kind of hazard to mm-hmm. use in the study.
What will you do with the findings of this survey?
Well, this is the work we're doing at the moment is a pilot study. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping to complete this relatively quickly, perhaps in the next 6 months or so. And we hope to publish and publicise the results of the study. But we're also hoping that it will provide some findings that will provide a steer for a larger scale, sort of nationwide project. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I guess we really want to know whether there is any potential for using a hazard perception test as a diagnostic tool here as well, something that could be incorporated into driver training and, you know, contribute to better road safety.
Mm-hmm. And your observations are going to be pretty much in the urban area, or are you going to move out of town as well?
For this study, the clips we're using are filmed in both sort of urban and rural environments. We like to look at both contexts, but the people we're actually going to be testing will be probably people local to this area. Mm-hmm. But in the future, it would be nice to, you know, look at people in different areas across Malaysia if we manage to move on to a larger scale project.
Okay. Right. Wonderful. So enforcement, infrastructure and education. That's all of it has to jive, doesn't it?
Yes.
Thank you both for joining us. Dr. Elizabeth Shepherd, the Assistant Professor of Psychology, and Dr. David Crundall, Associate Professor and Expert on the Psychology of Driving, talking to us about cultural aspects of road safety in Malaysia on the Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
BFM 89.9, the business station.